Hey everyone, thank you so much for tuning into Stoop Kids. I'm Cody Narveson, and you can find me on Twitter at Cody_BH.
I'm Harry Beck, and you can find me on Twitter at Shiitake Harry.
And I'm Emily Suey. You can find me on Instagram at Emily Suey.
And this episode was produced by super producer Jason Daphnis, who you can find on Twitter at Nintendoofus. You can also keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Stoop Kids Pod, and that's kids spelled with a Z. What you're about to listen to is our second conversation with the author and creator of Hey Arnold, Craig Bartlett. We first had the pleasure of chatting with him about a year ago when we were transitioning from season one to season two of the show. It was fabulous getting the opportunity to check in with him again, this time covering a lot of different memories specific to seasons two and three of Hey Arnold, as well as some Craig Bartlett specific origin stories from a time before Hey Arnold was even a show. We're thrilled to be able to share this conversation with all of you. So without further ado, please enjoy and thanks again for listening.
Hey Arnold! Bom, 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 bom.
Gotcha.
Thank you for listening. Oh, hey, yeah, it gives the are you ready? Hey, we're recording now, just so you know, we're rolling. I guess on that note, thank you for listening to Stoop Kids, a Hey Arnold podcast. We're kicking off season four in probably the best way possible. We've got an incredibly special guest with us today. He's the author of Hey Arnold, and if you can believe it, he's making his second appearance on Stoop Kids. Joining us today is Craig Bartlett. Craig, how are you doing today?
I'm great, well rested, ready to go. Hit me.
Yeah. Hey, perfect. Yeah. You know, not too many wild vacations in your recent past, so we'll be able to hit the ground running, I'm sure. But yeah, no. This is, you know, like we said, we're coming in. We wanted to, you know, kind of check in with you for a lot of reasons. We're partway through the series, and so what better way to kind of pivot and continue with the latter seasons of the show than take an uncensored approach. I should say that the rest of our episodes are low on swears, but hey, we're gonna let everything fly this episode. Nothing is.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, hey, yeah, take that with you. But yeah, I guess, you know, what I wanted, we all wanted to start with was, you know, we thought back about, you know, our last conversation that we had with you, Craig, and the types of things that we've been kicking around a lot, especially in, you know, the last couple seasons two and three. And, you know, we thought you were so eager to talk about how collaborative the show was, you know, at the outset specifically, because we were coming off of season one and, you know, we're talking about the types of people that formed the backbone of the show, you know, the Tuck Tuckers and the Jamie Mitchells of the world. And, you know, as we've gone through the past few seasons, you know, we always kind of keep an eye out for new names, and other names have sprouted up as credited contributors, you know, directors, writers, things like that. Some of them making a lot of contributions, you know, again, as far as credit, like actual official credits go, and some of them maybe only appearing once or twice so far. And I guess more than anything, thing, you know, as a starting point, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how, you know, members of your team sort of rotate in and out of those, I guess, hot seats, you know, why or how someone like, you know, Antoinette Stella or Stark Howell or Christine Kolosov or any of these other folks who kind of filtered in, maybe didn't have as big of an impact on the show's beginning, but, you know, we see their fingerprints all over some of these later seasons. So I don't know. I'd love to hear about that. What sort of sticks out to you?
Yeah, the difference between season one and seasons two and three is vast, because season one I think of as like the grand experiment. Like, almost seemed like every single thing we did was something new, and we tried things in all directions, and we would go, oh, this one, you know, the feedback loop of my crew and me watching the shows. We would go, I love this kind of show. Let's do more of these. And then we also were committed. Like, we knew we had to do Arnold-centric episodes, at least a few every season, and not let it just become like Arnold and Friends to the point where he, you know, kind of like faded into the background. We wanted to kind of find ways to bring Arnold forward. And he was competing with everybody, especially Helga. And that was fine. But also the difference between season one and seasons two and three is that we settled into our groove, and it took us all of season two to do so. Also, if you look at season two and three in terms of like the official, how they were released, that isn't necessarily how it went. We think of season two as a weird half season, really, even though it goes kind of like year by year. It would be 20 episodes a year, every year for 5 years. So you could go, for me, it was easy. It was like, what? It's, you know, it's 1996. I must be working on season two. It's 1997. I must be working on season three. And I knew too, that it was more than that. They rolled on into, they really, each season took about a year and a half to conceive, write, record, storyboard, animate, put through post and deliver. It really took about a year and a half. So the math seems kind of wrong, but really every January of each new year, I was starting up, all right, what are we making for season two? And I would make the big board, the big whiteboard that had all the show titles on it, and lead the crew through that. And so in my mind, it was always very clear. Season two is episodes 21 through 40. But they didn't really get packaged and delivered quite in that way. So when you talk about season two, especially, that was a weird transitional time. We started in China. The very first season was done in China, but the studio in China couldn't quite keep up. It got overwhelmed about two thirds of the way through season one. And we started looking around for other studios. We briefly were in, hey, look, I froze. You can hear me though. Okay. Right. Good. I'll keep going. So we basically started looking. We went to Taiwan briefly, and that was kind of the look of late first season, taking you into Christmas show, then into the beginning of season two, which I think of like Helga's Boyfriend, and you know that would be like the beginning of season two to me. And then that we kind of only did a few episodes in that kind of transitional time and settled into Seiram, the Korean studio that then stayed with us all the way through the end of the series run. So by the end of season two, we were settled into Seiram, say Opera, for example, Eugene Goes Bad. Those were Seiram shows. And then we had a lovely relationship with them that lasted through the end of the run. I will say that kind of rough and ready first season look, when I look back at it now, the China studio was kind of delightful in a way. Like the weird, it was kind of lumpy and bumpy, but very handmade in a way that when I look at it now has kind of tremendous value to me. So, I love them all. Okay. They're all like my weird, you know, different children. I was happy to settle into Seiram because they were lovely. I enjoyed going to Seoul. I thought there was a good understanding of what we were trying to do. And, you know, I mean, with Seiram, we made Parents' Day, we made School Play, we made Thanksgiving, we made Helga on the Couch, we made Married, you know, so there was a lot of really cool episodes that we made in our kind of more kind of like settled in and kind of relaxed mode of seasons 3, 4, and 5. Having said that, let me add that season 3 is when things really, really got good, in my opinion, in terms of the experience of making the show. It wasn't a brawl anymore. You know, the kind of people who were acting out and making trouble had been basically, you know, we just didn't bring them back and we were on our own. I will also add that on the exec level, Mary Harrington, who was present for seasons 1 and 2, moved on. She became an independent producer. And the people that they gave me for execs after that, I realized, I mean, Mary was totally the boss. She greenlit the show. She was the person running animation in Burbank. And so if she didn't want something, it wasn't going to happen. You know, I had to get everything past Mary. When season 3 started, I was like, oh my God, there's nobody to stop me. You know, this is my show. And I met with the crew. We would meet, believe it or not, we'd meet every Monday at 9 a.m. Can you imagine? The whole crew sitting there at 9 a.m. ready to start the week. And I mean, I wouldn't do that now, but we did it then. And on that first Monday, when we started season 3, I said, you guys, the inmates are running the asylum. This is going to be our show now. And the exec who was there was like, you know, like a little bit nervous, but I was like, no way I'm going to, you know, in my mind, I was like, no way am I going to take orders from this person. I'm going to tell him, look, we've got 40 half hours of this show and it's good. Just leave us alone. And then to the point that they left us alone, all of season 3, I don't remember getting notes on any scripts. I mean, I feel like there was something. They didn't like the second Coach Wittenberg show. They literally came into my office and wanted to have a meeting about how there's too many adult themes in the show. And they were like, Wittenberg's dominating this episode. He's on every page. Arnold's not even on as much as Wittenberg. This is a problem. And I said, why is it a problem? You know, kids like watching stories about grownups too. You know, I thought that was an irrelevant problem, but that was our only struggle. And that, you know, we just prevailed. And so in my opinion, the late third season is when things are really just kind of exploding in all directions. And, you know, Parents Day and school play and Thanksgiving were just like boom, boom, boom. And they're all nuts. They're crazy half hours where, you know, crazy stuff is happening and they feel like we had truly found our groove. Now, when I say that, I don't in any way mean to disparage seasons one and two. I know crazy magic happened at the beginning, at the outset. And in a way, it was hard to capture that spirit as we went further and further down the line. But I don't know. I'm sure we'll talk about Parents Day today. But, you know, I would consider that. I just felt tremendous freedom at that point. I felt like if I wanted to do something, I would just go, hey, how about this? And the answer was always yes. So I hope that answers your question. That's the journey I went on in those first 3 years.
That's fantastic to hear about. So last time we spoke with you too, we heard a lot from you about Arnold's Christmas, which was the first half hour special in the series. And so as we got going and more into seasons two and three, we also saw Arnold's Valentine later in season one. We saw Arnold's Halloween in season two. And then in season three, there was not only just the holiday special of Arnold's Thanksgiving, but there were the first like non-holiday half hour specials of school play and Parents Day, the big one. So I'm just curious to hear about how the process was for you, like working on those half hour specials versus more of those regular length episodes. Like, was the creative and collaborative process a lot different between forming those?
In a way, no. It meant if you're doing a whole half hour, you had two crews instead of one, like an 11 minute episode, like Helga Blabsdahl. I knew it would be Tuck and whoever was drawing with Tuck. It might be Shermer, or it might be Jay, or there were all these different people that were working for it, you know, on Tuck's team. But it would just be those two, and you know, cleanup artists and a couple board artists background artists would be assigned to that 11. But that was it. But when you had a half hour, you doubled that crew. So that was cool. It meant a larger team was making it. But the other real difference about making the half hour specials was that you had double the time to write the piece. And I'll give you an example. I'm getting ahead of myself here, but Arnold's Thanksgiving, that went through an amazing story process. And it was because, I mean, we got it done in time. We weren't late with it, but I remember we were kind of like, we were sort of spinning our wheels on the story of Thanksgiving. The basic concept was always there. And it was me and Steve Vixton and Joe Purdy who were writing that. But we got into it. We got two drafts into it and we weren't really very happy with it. It was like the basic premise was we'll open at school. They go on they go on Thanksgiving break. And then we will show Thanksgiving at Arnold's house and Thanksgiving at Helga's house. And the message will be the same that it came out, which is, hey, your Thanksgiving might kind of suck, but, you know, other people have worse Thanksgivings than you do. So, you know, suck it up, try to make the most of the day, you know, look for the love from your family. And that's all the best you can do. So it was a kind of a cool, I mean, a fairly dark episode, right? But, you know, the message was, hey, you know, let's be thankful. You know, there's gotta be something to be thankful for. And, the cool thing that happened was we'd written two drafts. I came to work one morning and Antoinette Stella, who you just referenced and was new on the crew as a writer, Antoinette was waiting outside my door. And so that was the worst, man. When you come to the office and someone's waiting outside your door and you're like, ah, crap, you know, and she just comes up and goes, I just really feel like we've got to change this story. I just don't think it works yet. And I just think it really needs to change. And I was like, man, let me unlock my door and turn on the lights and make a cup of coffee and just sit down on the couch and let's give me a minute. Good. And so Antoinette, who I just a wonderful collaborator, such a great soul. And she was just like literally upset. Antoinette was the kind of person who would go home and just like, I couldn't sleep. I was so upset that this wasn't right. I just had to, nothing's going to be okay until I pitch you my solution and we figure this out. So it was her suggestion, that wonderful symmetry, the school play was going to be Simmons has written his own play, which is so meta. It's like us, man. We will write these stories about our lives, and that'll be our subtext, is that this is kind of how it happened or how we feel, but we're having it being played out by the characters of Hey Arnold. So Simmons writes a little play, and the children are cast as his own family, his extended family. And they're all getting along, and it's beautiful. And the kids, you know, the kids are like, meh, meh, meh. And you know, Helga's like, yeah, right. When Simmons says it, and then you cut to him, and Simmons is literally talking along with he's got the script, and he's reading along with the characters. That was a brilliant idea. And then it was like, and then they both Arnold and Helga have their miserable Thanksgivings. They both run away. They find each other. You know, that part, I don't know if it was there or not, but the fact that they get together and Arnold thinks, well, Simmons seemed to be having a fantastic Thanksgiving. What if we went and visited him? And then they get there, and it's shown to be kind of worse than theirs. And that wonderful scene where Simmons comes into the kitchen and says, look, I know this isn't the perfect happy family that I showed in my play, but nevertheless, this is what I've got. And every year it's my little experiment to bring them all together and see if we can't get along and have a good Thanksgiving. So that once she pitched that whole way to do it to me, I was like, oh, fantastic. And then I said, look, you guys, Antoinette's idea is brilliant. I'll write draft three. And then I just wrote the whole thing over again. And the scene in the kitchen I wrote, and I'm super proud of it. I mean, when I see the kitchen scene, the performance is so brilliant. Everybody's being hilarious. Dan Castellaneta, who's Peter, Simmons' boyfriend. And I can't even remember the name of the, she was an old Broadway actress who played Pearl, Simmons' mom. And just all that is so juicy. The, you know, Simmons' mom doesn't seem to know that her son is gay, you know, and it's because they've got these rules about how they're going to get along. And Peter's really kind of cruel to her, kind of sniping at her. And so they're just shouting finally. And, you know, plates are crashing out in the living room when Simmons is in the kitchen with the kids. And the reason I love that scene so much, I would just play it over and over again because it just delights me, is Lang's score. That score, I don't even know what he called that cue, but I call it "The Kids Figure It Out." And I mean, that score is everything to me. And you know, that's when everything's clicking, all cylinders are firing, and tuck through that board. It's a really great board. I think Larry Likelighter was the timer on that one. You know, when there's a shared credit, an animation director and a storyboard director, that's how the labor is divided. Tuck, the storyboard director, drew the whole thing. Larry Likelighter timed it. He basically wrote the animation sheets about how the acting should go and is responsible for getting that storyboard translated into animation by Sayram. And you know, it was a great, you know, we were left completely alone. I finished that show and sent it to Nickelodeon, and they literally sent somebody out. They sent an exec out to me. This is the first time we'd heard back from them in months. We'd been making episodes and not hearing anything from Nickelodeon in New York. And they sent someone out to talk to me about Thanksgiving. He's like, they seem to be drinking wine. Simmons seems to be gay. You know, we have a lot of questions about this episode. And I basically had this conversation with him where I said, well, you're kind of too late, man. you could have caught that in script, but you didn't. And I, you know, it, I turned it into money. I said, yeah, we probably could get in there in post and color that line and make it look like water, but I'd probably cost you about $25,000. And I just saw in his face, he was like, I can't win this. This is going to be what it is. And it's ironically, the exec was gay. So I ended up having this long conversation with him about like why Simmons is gay, you know, and it was kind of a one-sided conversation. I just sort of told him where we were at. And when it was done, he was like, oh, you know, okay. And so that's how we did things in season three. We didn't have big fights. We basically were left to our own. And it was really, as always, the creative choices that people make when they're making something together. The collaboration on that one was fantastic. And again, you know, Antoinette Stella, a great collaborator, wonderful ideas, deeply passionate about who Arnold is and why. And the things that we spoke about last time about Arnold, kind of where he is on his spiritual journey and the kind of cool Buddha-like effect he has on everything and everyone. We were in total agreement about that. The writers would argue and fight and sometimes would not accept what someone else had done. But bottom line, they were all trying to make Hey Arnold be kind of powerful, have some kind of meaning. And so that Thanksgiving show especially rings true for me. I think about the great performances everybody does. They're all so good and funny. Dan Castellaneta, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the old actress who played Pearl, but they had to come in and loop that one, the ADR we call it, where they basically, we'd run the picture and they would, because we've drawn all this fighting, right? And then it hadn't been recorded. And that whole like, mother, you know, can you please keep it down? And she's like, keep this down, you know, from out in the, and Peter smashes something. He goes, oh, you know, like you can tell, it's just like the gloves are off out there. And Dan and Mitzi Gaynor, I think was her name. We can look that up. Those two were like stone cold ADR pros. I had no idea what her ability was to do looping, and they crushed it. When you know, the picture, the camera goes off of them for a while and it comes back to them, they were always like live. When it came back to them, the lips were moving just like they should. I was like, oh my God, these guys are fantastic. Another great ADR pro was Maurice LaMarche, Big Bob. And he and Dan Castellaneta, who played Nick Vermicelli in the first Arnold movie. Do you remember the giant fight scene where Nick slams Bob's head in the fridge? I just knew. I was like, oh my God, my two best ever ADR people are coming in to loop this fight. I'm just going to be, I'll just be laughing until I'm crying watching these guys go. You know, they just, the joy of cartoon making is stuff like that. You know, putting Arnold's Thanksgiving through post was just a complete joy. Also, we knew we had something good. I love that story. It's so weird, you know, and kind of not like anybody. No one has a life like those kids. They the things that they do, and they go out to look for some good news, and they see the Mayflower, and then it crashes into that bridge. It's just like and when they're talking, it comes back from the commercial break, and they're just sitting there kind of like talking about it. Helga's like, well, you know, look at this Thanksgiving sucks. Look at those people out there. And you can see them out there. If you listen really carefully, you can hear the walla that we did of the people on the rescue boat. And Joey Paul, our casting director, was with us in that loop group. And you can hear her go, like, apparently one of them is saying burr. yeah, you know, good times, really good times.
That's amazing.
I don't know where we were. Please continue.
No, that leads into my next question really well. You already sort of answered a lot of it. It's really incredible to hear that people like Antoinette Stella were that passionate about it. And now that I'm thinking about it, totally makes sense, right? Like you can really feel it in every episode. But that was what I was going to ask about, is that now that you had, especially in season three, that sort of creative freedom, what were the sort of things that you felt like you were getting away with? And do you think that like having that freedom changed the way that you and the other creators approach the show? Like, do you think that because you knew you could get away with things, you were taking bigger risks and stuff. And it sounds like that was at least true of Thanksgiving, but maybe in some other cases as well.
Yeah, let me think. As we talk about these shows, I'll keep that in mind because I think it's a really good point, Harry. And I would say the Thanksgiving, let's go home and find out what the Simmons kind of closeted home life is. And it'll make you, I mean, by the time you finish that episode, you just love Sim. I mean, I love Simmons anyway. I mean, what's not to love about that character? He's such a soulful guy, and he's doing what all teachers of grade school kids should do. He's super inspiring and kind of won't settle for less. And he wants them to learn to be creative. He's just great. He's a wonderful guy. But to find out how kind of sad that was, that he, you know, apparently can't even talk straight to his mom about the person that he loves. That was exactly the kind of thing we did in season three. I mean, I'll try to think about the other thing. Parents' Day feels like, I don't think I would have kind of taken on Parents' Day until season three. Like, I kind of felt like I had the confidence to do it. It was what a fun challenge to be like, oh boy. I mean, I started season three going, kids keep writing these little telegrams online. This is in the infancy of like chat rooms and such, you know, in the mid 90s. Kids were writing in all caps, like, where's Arnold's parents? And I thought, man, this isn't going to go away. And we may have talked about this, but the relationship with Arnold's parents was, it occurred to me that my glib explanation of where they were when I pitched the show to Mary in 94 was not going to hold anymore. It had gone too long. Arnold had, we'd only seen like a glimpse in the hat and a couple other places. We'd only seen a glimpse into the fact that Arnold is apparently maybe an orphan. He's being raised by his grandparents, and I hadn't dealt with it. And so I thought, well, now I can't, you know. When we got to season three, I thought, nobody's minding the store, man. I can write whatever crazy ass story I want to write for Arnold. And if it's true to me, it feels like something that is important to Arnold and Arnoldy or Helga E. I'll just do it. And we're just going to drive 90 miles an hour forward and just see if anybody stops us. And I would also add, it really was that way. We were always on a short schedule. We had to make, I kind of felt like it was almost like this week's story that I can really concentrate on. And by next Monday, it was going to be time to start thinking about the next one. And so like a special would be great. You had twice as long to kind of, you know, make that one the featured story that everybody was really talking about and working on. And so that's how it went. And I definitely, Harry, we felt bold enough to kind of try things. As we talk, I'll try to think of other examples where, wow, we got away with it in season three and two. If you have a question about something that seems kind of wild and how did you get away with that, you know, ask me and I'll let you know.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, thinking about the types of things that, I mean, y'all were getting away with, or even just sort of the boundaries you were massaging, and you already, you know, articulated a lot of those already, the sort of how many different types of, you know, adult thematic elements can we squeeze in? What sort of quota can we flirt with regards to like Arnold-centric episodes, while also making sure we tell the proper stories about Arnold's history that viewers, you know, ultimately they want to see and think that they're tuning in for. And, you know, we couldn't help but notice, especially with season three, jumping back in, you know, we're talking about all the ways in which season three marks a big shift. We see a big shift in Arnold's character, sort of less of him being the person experiencing these thematically important lessons, which he always is, you know, at the very least in flashes. But, you know, we see more of him being either a conveyor or communicator of themes, maybe a little bit more explicitly than other times. Or, you know, he's somebody removed from the thematic journey of an episode entirely. And I guess, and you've already spoken to this a little bit, but I guess to put a a finer point on it. I mean, if you wouldn't mind talking about just kind of to what extent was that a conscious choice? Was it, you know, as you were developing, that was sort of an unintended but welcome like consequence or side effect of where you were wanting to take the show? How did that feel from your side?
That's a good question. I felt like with Arnold, it really was a bit of a problem for us. How many times can Arnold screw something up for somebody with the best of intentions, like Eugene's bike being a super early model that we were always kind of trying to find another Eugene's bike, or Stoop Kids? Great, man. The footballs landed on his stoop and it's like, way to go, Arnold. You know, of all the places in the whole neighborhood for the ball to go, you had to leave it on Stoop Kid's stoop. It's like, well, obviously Arnold just kicked the ball like a block away. He wasn't shooting for the stoop. So those kind of Arnold innocently gets himself into a jam that he's going to have to kind of make everything okay. Those were they were few and far between. They were kind of hard to come by. So he became a little bit more, I think, kind of proactively like seeking doing good. It became a little more meta as it went along. There's a lot of me trying to kind of almost, you know, through Arnold, set up what we talked about the Christmas show, where Arnold was sort of spiritually kind of guiding that story. And I felt like I kind of did that more and more with Arnold. And I think my shows, the ones that I wrote, I would think of it that way. I'd be like, well, I'm not going to ask that of anybody else, but I'm going to try to write an episode that kind of reveals the mechanics of this universe. And so I would say Girl Trouble is a good example. Girl Trouble is one where Arnold acts out. He pours the paint on Helga, you know, and that was a big deal. Again, Antoinette came waiting in front of my office door again, like, draft two of that one. Arnold was meaner than he is. I don't remember how different it was, because, you know, once it got finished, I kind of couldn't remember all the versions, but I do remember Antoinette going, if you let this stand, and it was my script. I was, you know, Sherman and I did the story, but since Sherman's a storyboard guy, I wrote it. So, you know, it's definitely my story. And I would say for me, what that story is really about is that, oh, what do you know? Gertie and Phil were basically Arnold and Helga, and we'll tell the story of how Gertie got along with Phil when they were children, and it'll be a carbon copy of the Helga Arnold relationship. And in fact, of course, we cast Franny to play little Gertie, so it could not be missed. By the way, I realize with Girl Trouble, I think that's the first time I named her. I think she was Pookie, her nickname we had heard many times before, or Grandma, of course. But I think it was the first time Arnold would know who Gertie was. I mean, that's his grandma. But the audience doesn't know necessarily that Gertie is Grandma until she comes in at the end and kisses Phil on the head and goes, oh, wasn't I adorable? So, I mean, I don't know, probably a lot of kids that were quick on the uptake figured that was Grandma as soon as she shows up when Grandpa goes through the scrapbook of old photos. But I wanted it to be a kind of a fun reveal. And then you go, oh, okay. Also, Grandpa's just, it's very meta. Grandpa's like, what do you mean, that little girl with the one eyebrow giving you trouble again? And Arnold's like, yeah, you know, and you're like, I don't know. I don't know why. And she's like, maybe she likes you, Arnold, and says, I don't know, man. I often see her out front, you know, jumping rope or something, and she seems to be standing around waiting for you to come out. And Arnold's like, oh, that's ridiculous, Grandpa. That couldn't be happening. So I could reinforce all my tropes. You know, Arnold is a kind of a dense. With girls, he doesn't really get it. And the girls are way ahead of him. And, you know, he'll learn, but for now, he's a kind of wonderfully naive about this stuff, because it makes, you know, it makes for funny stories. And I just remember when I was writing those stories, I realized, yeah, I'm kind of like laying down the, you know, here we are in another season, and I'm going to remind the audience about all the relationships and about, you know, why does Helga act like this? Why does Arnold act like that? Helga has big on the nose speeches at the front of that one. Girl Trouble. Yeah. I'm trying to, I think, is it Girl Trouble. Is that the one where at the front, I think Simmons even reads her poem aloud to the group. And, you know, like the one where each morn I see you bend a drink from love's own crystal pool, or maybe that's, maybe I've got the wrong one. Maybe that's a love potion. but I wrote that one too. But I, that would be me going, I gotta lay all this pipe. I gotta have the audience, you know, have Helga tell the audience once again, you know, why she can't, you know, tell Arnold how she feels, and her poems have to be, you know, just so. And I love, personally, I loved writing the love poems. I like Helga acting out. I like her, you know, the drama queen stuff. That's the bread and butter. So yeah, I mean, we knew it. I found myself writing the stories that I've kind of felt would either advance the kind of saga, like Parents' Day. I knew only I could take that on. I mean, it was co-written with Antoinette, but I knew I should, you know, kind of direct that story, because I was trying to tell the audience something they didn't know yet about Arnold, and kind of reveal, to take us deeper into the character. And I would write the kind of meta on the nose stories. I remember when the board team was going to draw, what's that one called? The Pig War. And I wrote that one too. I just wanted to be, I remember in Washington State when I was a kid, there had been a pig war in the San Juan Islands between the U.S. and the British, where actual fact, the U.S. had settled one end of San Juan Island, and the British from Canada was still then like some British colony. And they settled and put a fort on the other end of San Juan Island. And an American farmer, shot a British pig that had gotten into his garden. And it was, you know, it was almost started a war. So that's why I wrote the Pig War. But I remember when Jay Lender was going to draw it, he was on the board team. I think it was Sherman. Jay did that one. And Sherman was fine with it, but Jay was like, the story, it just seems like it was written by like a fanfic written by like a crazy Arnold fan. And I was like, well, I guess I am kind of a crazy Arnold fan, Jay. So, yeah, I mean, I can identify that kind of urge on my part with these stories too. They really are written by kind of the show's biggest fan. And I'm trying to kind of like move the ball down the field, you know, in a way where I don't feel like that pressure has to be on any of the other writers.
Man, so I'm also just wanting to pick your brain on other memories of like things happening in the studio as you were making this. And mm-hmm. obviously music is such a huge, crucial part of the show, from Jim Lang, of course, with the score and the theme, to like the kids themselves, the characters singing in productions, in like their school productions, like in What's Opera,
yeah.
and Gerald's Tonsils. And then you have the big adult characters like crooner Dino Spumoni. You've got Phoebe's favorite pop star, Ronnie Matthews. And of course, Mr. Wynn, the Sunset Arms Borders brief stint in the music industry.
Yeah.
So just wonder if you have any memories you'd be willing to share about like seeing those performances come together in that studio.
Yeah. Thank you for asking. It makes me, when I listen to those, it takes me back to the session and the location very strongly. I mean, last time we spoke, I talked about Horta, that big old, you know, cement stage in Burbank that was very old school, you know, Hollywood TV, you know, voiceover and TV production place that I loved. It was just like so kind of just felt like you were in this weird, like historical space where cool stuff had happened. And we recorded opera we'd moved to the new studio. Horta then moved into another location that was more modern. But I do remember the opera night. It was in winter, because when we came out, it was dark night. We went in and started the session. Probably, I think we started those sessions about like, they probably went from like 3 to 7, you know, four hour union session. We had to record all of that episode in 4 hours. And it was a deal, you know. And I remember that's one of the things I love about the work, is that it's time for the next cue. You know, first one, how did it go? I think we went, Arnold sings first. My name's Don Arnold. Please have a caramel. And then Ruth sings her bit. And then Helga sings, you know, Helga's a Viking. Da, 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 da. And I Harold Big Ugly Clown. Oh, he was very early. He was kind of, I tended to always record page by page. I'd kind of say, everybody show up at 4. We're going to start on page 1. If you're not in it till page 12, no problem. Take a seat. And sometimes they'd sit out in the green room and not be part of the action. But the kids especially, they loved it, man. They really loved going through and listening to the story unfold. And so when it was time for them, they knew the context of what they were doing and why. And it would give it this great, like, live, like a radio show was what I always called it. I felt like, and you know, that's like a podcast. It's like, we're gonna start at the beginning. We're going to work our way through it. And when we're done, we'll say what happened. And yeah, recording opera was just a highlight. It was just so much fun. Each kid that followed would try to, you know, do better than the one before them. And I remember Franny kind of struggling with it at first. She kind of thought she should sound kind of all opera-y. And Lang, of course, was there. Jim and I were there for the entire session. And Jim was saying, no, Franny, sing it like you're Helga, okay? And don't get fruity. It's not right. It's Helga singing this. And then the other kids, like Torin, who sings, my name's Don Arnold. And he had just been replaced by Philip. Philip does the talking parts of opera, but Torin's voice had already kind of cracked and he couldn't talk it anymore, but he could still sing it, which I don't even understand, but that's how it went. And he was great. Torin was a singer. He knew he wanted to even grow up to be a rock and roller. He wanted to be a pop, you know, I'm sure he wanted to be like Justin Bieber or something, but we were like, Torin, listen, man, dumb it down. Sing like a kid, okay? You know, kids aren't that good. Kids don't sound like the radio, you know, like sound like a kid. And I think he did a good job of kind of like, you know, kid-izing his performance. But yeah, that was generally the challenge with Torin. And then if you played the whole group, you know, you got Stinky and Sid in there and Gerald, and there's some off-key singing, you know? If you listen to the end, the contest of brute strength wrestling in the mud, that bit that plays at the end. It's listen to it, man. There's some really off key singing in there. And that's what I love. I'm no kidding. I mean, there's a really authentic sound that you get. And we did that, you know, when they sing on Moonlight Bay, you mentioned that one too. You know, there's some kind of not all there singing going on because it was partly the direction I was giving them, but also some kids just weren't, they just, you know, they were never going to sing in tune. And it you just kind of took each of these kids and tried to, you know, find their strength. You know, I knew that Franny was always an outstanding performer. And if anything, you'd have to sometimes get her to kind of like, please kind of dumb this down a little bit. Curly was last of all. Remember, Curly comes and sings the Curlimeo. And that's the last one. And so I didn't know how it was going to go. I really didn't. I didn't know how Adam was going to do. I hoped is Adam Wiley, the best of all the Curlies. There were many Curlies after his voice cracked, and we had to just say, listen, man, you got to laugh maniacally like Adam did because there's nothing like it. And they'd be like, they would try, and I'd be like, well, that's okay, but it ain't Adam Wiley. But Adam got up there, man, and he sang that Curlimeo thing. We were all just like, our jaws were on the floor. And I'm so thrilled with that. And then Adam went on and did Broadway and stuff. So as an adult actor, he went and did musicals and stuff. So who knew? I didn't know when we cast. We'd cast everybody, and it was just basically like, hey guys, I'm going to have you come in and sing, you know, some Mozart and some, you know, the, you know, basically the Carmen is the main, you know, the main song source, but a little Mozart and odds and ends. I forget what the Big Ugly Clown, oh, that I don't even remember who that composer is, but and you know, my goal with opera was I had grown up on What's Opera Arnold and Rabbit of Seville, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to make a musical tour of classical music so the kids would see how cool it was. I mean, Carmen's wonderful. And they would then someday hear Carmen and go, my name's Don Arnold, please have a caramel, and be like, and there's that funny thing too. We might've talked about this before where I'd put a reference to a movie or, you know, I'd replay some bit of classic TV or movie and think, this is the first time they're going to see this, man. When they finally see Streetcar Named Desire, they're going to go, what the hell, man? I saw that on Hey Arnold. yeah, so, you know, I always tried to borrow from the best, and we had our favorite, you know, music or pop culture references that we went back to again and again. As I thought about seasons 2 and 3, I remembered there's at least two Taxi Driver quotes, and there's three because he's in Mugged. He's doing De Niro's "You Talking to Me?" But there was also, God, what was it? There was when Eugene goes bad and he paints his room black, the last thing he does, and it's the cut. No, then he paints the screen black, and that's the cut. But just before he does that, he's watching TV, and it's the abdicator, and you just see his boot come in and shove the TV over, and it smashes. That's from Taxi Driver. And the other Taxi Driver reference was Career Day, where Arnold's out with the Jolly Ollie Man, and that the music was meant to sound just like the orchestration of Taxi Driver as he talks about like the shitty city and how sucky it is, and you know, one day it rain's gonna wash. I mean, it's basically he's doing Travis Bickle's early monologue about like how much he hates everything.
I think we literally called it a Paul Schrader monologue in our episode about
yeah. So you can see, you know, that's what made us laugh. And you know, kids aren't gonna see Taxi Driver, man. They're not gonna see Taxi Driver, hopefully, until they're at least, you know, teenagers. That's a very, very grim picture. But you know, what can I say? We loved old TV comedies, and we loved 70s movies, man. New Hollywood, you know, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, kind of, you know, 70s movies. And I still love 70s movies, man. I don't know if you know, they in LA, they built the Academy, the Movie Academy, built a new museum. And I've been raving about this to all my friends. I'm like, you got to go. The museum has a new theater called the Geffen. It's a beautiful new 1,000-seat, gorgeous, fantastic new space. And they're showing the Academy branches are all taking turns showing their favorite, like it's the sound, you know, branch of the Academy. We're going to show the best sounding pictures. It's the cinematographer's branch. It's the casting one, or I just saw the 82 Blade Runner, because it was production design branch, put that one up. And these films, you know, you see them projected as beautifully as possible. There's always, if it's a branch screening, they always have somebody from the branch come and do a little Q&A, or, you know, do a little kind of chalk talk where they showed how it was done. And I've been watching the best of the 70s and 80s and just having such a good time, you know, and it makes me think of the old days. It makes me think of Joe and Sol Behar and Steve Vixton. And the three of us would just sit around and talk about 70s movies all day long. We'd go, well, okay. We all agree we love Apocalypse Now. Wouldn't it be cool if we could quote something from Apocalypse Now with these characters? And, you know, was that the right thing to do? I have no idea, man. By the time we got to season three, we were kind of set free, and we were quoting whatever the hell we wanted. And so, you know, seasons 2 and 3, you see Taxi Driver quoted twice. And it doesn't matter that kids maybe will ever see that movie. We know what that has. It has music, and it has really gritty kind of the philosophy of those scenes is something that kids can relate to. You know, this is really dark. Poor Arnold, man. He's that's a very funny extreme to go to, that Arnold gets stuck with the Jolly Ollie Man. But oh man, it turns out the Jolly Ollie Man's like Travis Bickle. So it's a really bad ride for Arnold. You know, it's like And so, you know, and therein lies the comedy. Arnold's having the worst day ever. And you would think getting to hang out with the ice cream man all day would be the best day ever. So, you know, simple, but, you know, simple, but crazy. And no one was giving us notes, man.
Well, I mean, how do you...
I don't remember anybody saying you can't do that or, you know, that's too weird.
That's amazing. I mean, you can't make them. Show about an American city and not constantly reference Taxi Driver. It's just in it. I'm glad that you're into the best decade for making movies, by the way. 70s was number one peak. You agree with that, don't you, Cody? I think we're on the same page about that. Yeah. Okay. I have to ask a question about Helga because I love her so much.
Sure.
Which is just that one of the things that last time we talked that blew my mind the most was that you said that the whole Helga having a crush on Arnold wasn't your idea originally. But in seasons 2 and 3, especially in the episodes that you wrote, like Helga Blabs It All or Girl Trouble or Helga's Love Potion, that's really like, I would say the primary focus of the show, right, is about navigating the weird relationship that she has with Arnold and herself. So I guess between the inception of the show and season 3, what was it about Helga and Helga's crush that was so important to you or that you liked writing so much that you wanted to make it such a big focus of the show? Is that just sort of how it worked out, or did you find something in that really spoke to you?
Yeah, what a great question. The answer is Francesca Marie Smith. she was so phenomenal. She was a child phenomenon. And also, I just found it, you know, at season one, by the time season one was over, I thought, look at the depth of this love. You know, Helga stays up all night with Mr. Bailey to get, you know, gives up her precious Nancy Spumoni snow boots that Miriam waited in line all day for. Yeah, how's she going to explain that to Miriam when she gets on? Where's the boots? You know, I'm sure Miriam never and Bob never knew why the boots weren't there anymore. I'm sure Helga stayed tight-lipped about that one. Take that secret to her grave. It would be funny, actually, to have people, fans often ask, they're like, well, does Arnold finally know who his Christmas angel is? They're like really upset. They kind of can't stand that he doesn't know. And I'm like, no, you know, the quality of storytelling is secrets are kept, man. You know, we're talking about the joy of sacrifice, personal sacrifice. It's much better if you're not tooting your horn, and it just gives you so much to chew on about Helga's character. By the time you finish season one, you know, this is probably, she could go toe to toe with Arnold on anything. She's a really powerful character, like someone you want to see more of. And that's really how I felt. I was like, well, I sure love this Helga character. I can't believe I had anything to do with the creation of this character. She's so good. And so that was me. And that, you know, that is a good point that you make, Harry, that all those ones that you mentioned were ones that I wrote because I'm just like, more Helga, man. And those poems, you know, where each morn I see you bend a drink at love's own crystal pool, I tremble near you, trying to think, will I forever say you stink? Am I bound by this tragic rule? I mean, writing that was super fun. It's my favorite thing to do practically is, you know, songwriting. If you think about that, each morn I see you bend to drink at love's own crystal pool. That's the rhyme scheme that I always use. Da 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 da. Rest, repeat. That's the way I write songs. It's the way I write Helga poems. And it's super fun for me. Then you go, now I've done this, and next time I saw Franny, I'd be like, oh boy, Franny, wait till you see this one, you know? And the stories would advance the plot of Arnold and Helga are soulmates. She secretly loves him. Someday he's going to have to find out. And won't that be fun when Helga finally, you know, blabs it all, as I said in, you know, the name of that episode, she blabs it all, but somehow Arnold doesn't know, you know, again and again, stupid Arnold can't figure out the truth. And then finally she'll tell him in the movie. And then even the movie, man, we were, you know, Steve and I were determined to have her ride it, you know, run it all the way back. You know, she walks it back and says, Yeah, that didn't really happen. You know what I mean? Like, and then she dances off down the street like, yes, you know, I didn't have to give up my secret to Arnold. And yet, you know, then she, my thought was, you know, 5 minutes later, she's going to stop jumping for joy and go, wait, God damn it. You know, I don't know how Arnold feels. And so that was really the gas that was driving the whole series. And I discovered it by the time I finished season one. I was like, well, with this actor, Francesca, we have a super Francesca, Jim Lang, Tuck Tucker. These are the people that were like my secret weapons, right? Or not so secret weapons. And I was like, with these players, I can make some gold here. And that's why I wrote so many of those Helga Arnold stories, because to me it was fundamental. It was the heart of the whole thing. And if you look at the Jungle movie, it's sort of like the conclusion of this. It was all meant to take you to the place where finally Arnold had he's a very smart and wise kid, but he finally, like, the veils were all lifted and he was like, oh my God, this girl has done everything for me. She's just like, she would make any sacrifice for me. And he's really moved and he realizes he loves her. So it's meant to be. I wanted it to be that way, where Arnold, you know, you can see how important he is for Helga. He's kind of making it okay for Helga to just survive. You know, he's like, he's got the sort of tenderness that no one else is showing her. And so, you know, to me, that's enough to hang a whole series on. Is like, can we follow this to its inevitable conclusion? And Married is, of course, I know we're not there yet in your podcast, but Married is meant to be, don't worry, kids. You look at them there watching the sunset as adults. And it's Phoebe who knows this, you know? So it's all heading to a very sweet conclusion is my, Helga will find happiness. She hasn't yet, but she will.
By golly, will she ever. So I've read a lot of your other interviews, and we know that Hillwood, their city in the show, is based around your time in Seattle and Portland and Brooklyn. And the internet also mentions that a trip to Italy might have inspired your career in animation even further.
Yeah.
So you've lived in and worked in LA, of course, and you're in Catalina, and you've been in all these amazing places. So I'm just curious to hear about, like, any favorite aspects you've seen or experienced in any of those cities, like things that inspired you.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question, Emily. I feel like the setting of my childhood is kind of everything. I mean, and it's weird too. It's like, I lived in Seattle until I was about 12. And then my family moved us to the beach up in Northern Washington, which was very remote and a very small, tiny town. And like, it isn't like the beaches here in LA with gorgeous white sand beaches that are like a half mile wide. It was like a cold water Puget Sound and like rocks and barnacles, and you couldn't walk barefoot on the, you know, it's like, it's that kind of a beach. And so not really that much of a gritty urban upbringing. I visited the city's, you know, kind of gritty cores more as an art student. When I was like 18, I went down to Portland first and lived in a downtown apartment and walked, you know, I had no money. So I walked the streets, the downtown streets of Portland, taking pictures, and in art class, we'd be drawing things. And so my kind of young adult take on Seattle and Portland, and then Brooklyn, I had relatives in Brooklyn, and kind of seeing Stoop Life and those kind of all those Brooklyn blocks, which I love, where the block has a core of like a shared garden space that everybody on that block all kind of like lives in side by side. Those things I saw more as a young adult, and I applied that love of those things and architecture, the love of architecture in general, which was very strongly influenced by that year in Italy. And I turned 21 when I was in Italy. And so very young, very impressionable. And a teacher told me, I had a sculpture teacher at the art school in Portland. I told Charles Kelly, and I told him, he said, "Hey, I heard you got accepted for the year abroad in Italy." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, congrats. That's incredible." And I said, "I'm kind of worried, you know, I'm going to leave my friends and maybe I won't be able to reconnect when I come back. What about that?" And he said, "Oh, forget them. Forget your friends. You're going to Italy. You're going to get your mind blown. You will not care about any of that shit when you get to Italy and get your mind blown. So just don't even worry about that. Don't give it another thought." And I thought, well, that's kind of harsh when he told me. And when I got there, I was like, oh, man, Charles Kelly was absolutely right. And then true enough, I did not reconnect. I came back to Portland and had trouble transferring those credits to finish there. And I said, well, fine, fuck you. And I went to Washington, back to my home state, and went to Evergreen State College in Olympia, which is a famous hippie college where no grades and it was like a magnet for every weirdo, every creative weirdo in the Northwest knew about Evergreen. And so I finished at Evergreen, and that's where I got into animation and really kind of started the whole ball rolling. And so I love that whole experience. I love 2 years of classical art training in Portland. I love my year in Italy. I will never forget it. And I talk about that to people all the time because when people are getting started and they want to kind of break into the business, they're like, what should I do? What should I study? Where should I go? I say, look, man, you can come to LA and study at the great, you know, CalArts or the great industry schools if you want, or you can do what I did, which was a complete backdoor, weird alternative thing where I went to art school in Portland, went to Italy, got my mind blown, completely got knocked off the track and took years to recover. No shit. I came back from my year in Italy and the culture shock was so intense. I didn't know how to carry on. I was like, I can't stay here in rural Washington. This is just not, it's not floating my boat. I'm going to have to go. And it finally, that kind of getting knocked off the track is probably why I was primed to, become a clay animator and then come down and do claymation for Pee-wee. That I was like one of those outsider weirdos that show was made of. So I credit the crazy dissociation I kind of went through because I had gone to Italy and I just was like, well, everything about this is different. Everything they do, the lifestyle here is completely different. Can I ever be Italian? Could I stay until they took me for one of their own? And the answer ultimately was no. I was like, I think I'm something else. I think I have to go back, but I'm really going to, my mind's been scrambled. I'm going to have to figure out how to be again. And so I just tell people, I don't know, go out and see the world, man. Maybe you won't even take a single drawing course or an animation course. I didn't, I studied, there were basically Italian, old school Italian fine art was the program I took there. I did some sculpting and drawing, but really it was me and my friends bumming around being, kind of vagabondage, as they call it, where we were hitchhiking up and down Italy and just seeing how far you could stretch a buck. and an absolute joy. Also, I made friends with, there are four of us from that program. We still hang out. They're some of my best friends. Three people from that program, Mary, Lynn, and Kevin, all live in New York State. And that was one of the best friendships you could make. And I think that happens to everybody at that sort of like super vulnerable, you're young, you're just kind of having your first experiences. You might make those sort of friends for life in that situation. And when we started Hey Arnold, there were a lot of young 20s people on the crew and they were all hooking up. And I was like, look at that, man. Look, I've got a situation here where these people are going to be friends for life. And that just made me happy. I felt like I was kind of sponsoring some kind of great, like lifelong friendships. And, so that was what, those were each of those places where I lived as a kid had their profound effect on me. Downtown Seattle and Portland, the kind of the dark, underbelly of both those cities was really fascinating to me. And the historical aspect of it, you know, I think I worked some of that into Hey Arnold too. Like the history of Hillwood is very important, and the urban legends that Gerald tells are, you know, me responding to how much I loved, you know, inner city life. Same with Brooklyn. And we tried to put our favorite, you know, there's a Brooklyn Bridge basically in Hillwood. And that's because the Brooklyn Bridge is so cool. We just took whatever we wanted from, we cherry picked from all the best urban spaces and, you know, translated that in. The things that I saw in Italy, I'll just never forget. It was, one, you know, one morning I was hitchhiking from Napoli to Rome and realized I was standing on the Via Appia, which is a Roman road that's, I don't know, 2,200 years old. And I was looking down this straight line until it kind of reached the mountains, and it had to kind of turn or jog around the mountains. And there were these huge umbrella pines just going to the horizon. And I was just standing out there on this road going, oh crap, man, people rode chariots down this thing once. And that kind of mind blowing, I would just recommend to anybody. It did me so much good. You know, even trying to learn Italian, trying to like negotiate through foreign countries in another language, it's just good for your head. And it's hard to say how that all applies to Hey Arnold, but it does.
Yeah. Wow. What an excellent answer. Thank you. great question too, Emily. We have one more question if you've got the time.
I do.
Excellent. Which is just that we would be remiss not to discuss Parents' Day, right? I mean, like, you said something this session that totally blew my mind, which is that it wasn't sort of like planned from the beginning. Because to me, when we watched that episode, I was like, particularly the flight sequence that Arnold has in his daydream, I was like, oh, this is probably like the first thing that they thought of, and they built the entire show around it, because it feels like it's that much a linchpin of what the entire show is all about, right? So it's really surprising to me that that wasn't the case. And I would just love to hear, like, how did that story come to be, and who influenced it, and how did it end up the way it ended up? Because it's such a, you know, a triumph right in the middle of this series. And it feels like a real culmination of all of the themes that had been built into the show up to that point. So I'm really interested in how you made that happen, I guess.
Thanks. It's a great question. It's one of my favorite things to talk about, especially because the fun of hearing y'all ask me, how did you know this was going to work? Or how did you all like agree so well? Or how did you guys sync up so hard? And the truth is, it's just, it was a gift. I didn't know that it would go so well. I just kind of had a certain, I don't know, I have a kind of a native optimism. I think things are going to work out. That's kind of in my DNA. So that's probably really useful for gathering a group of people and going, hey, let's all do this together. And like I say, by the time we got to Parents' Day, we were at the end of season three. We were on a roll, and we knew we'd made a bunch of good stuff by then. So we had tremendous confidence. And also, I'd kind of cleared the deck. Some of the people who were not really copacetic were kind of rolled off by then. And I had a very tuned in, dialed in crew who wanted to do, you know, kind of help me do whatever I wanted it to be. Parents' Day, like I said, I was, you know, I was two solid years of Nick online, you know, seeing messages from children who wanted to know where are the parents. And I was like, oh boy. So here's how it started. Early in season three, we were, like I said, everything was going great. We were kind of on our own. We were feeling our oats, and we were like, let's try this. Let's try that. And I said to the group of writers, you know, I feel like I gotta do a parents episode. I gotta do, what if we by the end, let's talk about it all year. and by the end of the year, let's make episode 60, the last one on this whiteboard I'm doing here with the big board that's got all the names of the shows. How about by episode 60, the whole half hour, I'll do a parents special. And I remember Steve was like, He did not like the idea. Steve was like, I mean, he kind of liked things to be more on the gritty side. And there's something about Parents' Day where I was determined too. I said, look, we've got a problem here. They haven't even written a postcard. I don't think that's cool. It kind of implies that his parents are jerks. They've abandoned him to the grandparents because they're so selfish that they want to, you know, not have to take care of a kid while they're out pursuing this apparently like documentary shooting career. I originally pitched them as like they're shooting docs in Africa. And you know, I was really glib. I said almost no more than that. Like they're busy. And so I thought, no, okay. Arnold has been revealed to be a very good kid. And he really wants the best for everyone. He's kind of trying to make things good. And I thought, what if he's compensating? What if it's because there's this giant hole in his heart. His parents are gone and we haven't even touched on it. So how are we going to get there? So Antoinette, Steve was like, eh. And Joe also was pretty neutral. He didn't take the bait either. Joe Purdy. Antoinette was like, that sounds great. Can I write it with you? I said, yeah, I'd love it. You know, you can help me. I'll tell you all this giant problem I'm trying to solve with this. It was literally like I painted myself into a corner. We need to meet the parents and I want them to be good. I want Arnold's DNA is that he's the child of these really good people. So what happened? And so I thought, they are doctors and scientists, really. They're not. We never said what they were, so they didn't have to be documentary makers. They're doctors and scientists, and they both are the kind of people who want to go kind of doctors without borders. They kind of want to go out and be on the very edge of things, bringing science and health to people who, you know, remote places. And mom is shown to be kind of like a botanist or something. You know, remember when she comes up with a serum for the sleeping sickness and she's like, butterflies have something to do with it in the journal, which we didn't get to that till, you know, that was years later where I got to there. But I knew that much, like mom and dad are both these kind of cool, outdoorsy scientists, doctors who are out looking for cures in the hardest to get to places in the deepest jungle. That seems cool and aspirational. And you know, dad is revealed to be, like talking about the clouds. He sees like a clipper ship in the clouds and his friend's like, man, you know, boy, look at you with your head in the clouds. So I thought, okay, I'll give them traits that Arnold can have inherited. And mom's, if you look at her design, mom is the one who Arnold got his looks from. He kind of got dad's hair and mom's kind of football head. And then I'll just make them delightful. This is really nice. And I played dad. I played Miles. Antoinette played Stella. So that was cool. It kind of kept it right at home. And as we developed it, we didn't have to worry about explaining it to an actor. You know, we're like, you know, we'll write it. We'll know the material front to back and we'll play them. And so that was, Antoinette, by the way, had come to Hollywood to be an actor. She'd come to be like a, you know, just be like an ingenue and be like a the 20 something female in things. And she said the career went so badly that she quickly, you know, man, I am not going to make it as an ingenue. I'm going to start writing. And that's how she came to it. So I knew she was an actor and I thought, well, we can do this. That's how we arrived at the Parents' Day story. And then the school competition, it was a full half hour. And so I knew, well, we can set this up, have the middle part of the story be grandpa telling this wonderful story of Miles, especially, and how he met Stella and that they fell in love. And that's how Arnold came to be. And then Arnold would have his dream in which he understands his dream is about all the really kind of wonderful parenting that Phil and Pookie did as he grew up. And, you know, that they were really kind of the best ever, you know. Miles says, we're going to be back in a couple of weeks from the jungle and then never return. And then you can tell grandma and grandpa had to kind of do a giant pivot and go, I guess we're raising this kid. And I wanted it to feel like the storytelling you guys mentioned in your podcast about Parents Day, that you can see Arnold's going through so much here. He's spent years and years enjoying grandpa's tall tales, but figuring grandpa was just telling him a bunch of tall tales. And then the storytelling that grandpa's doing in this one is like, wait a minute. You know, come on, grandpa. When he starts to go like, and then Dr. Ironclaw with his, and I was like, grandpa, and there's like a needle scratch and you go, this time tell me the fucking truth, man. And it's very dear. And you know, what can I say? Phil Van Dyke, who was our Arnold then, does a wonderful, very low key, like you can just feel the pain of like he wants to know, and he kind of needs his kooky grandparents to kind of settle down and tell him straight, you know. And so grandpa, you know, Dan Castellaneta's performance in that as grandpa is just one of the greatest things I've ever done. I can't believe how cool it was. And I knew I could write this stuff. Like Big Bob was going to be like such a monster, and Helga was going to have a big scene about it with Arnold, and then, you know, make a decision to kind of throw her lot in with Arnold and his family and kind of sabotage her dad's plan to win the trophy. And there's just, there's a lot going on. And it's like Maurice who played Big Bob, Franny's Helga, Phil's Arnold, by the way, that's where I think that might've been why I decided to call Grandpa Phil. I might have thought of it first, and then, but I thought, well, this is great. It's kind of all in the family, you know, Phil Van Dyke and Phil Shortman. But the, you know, all these actors are why it's so good. And also, once again, Lang, I see YouTubes of people playing the Parents Day theme almost more than anything else. Piano players love that Parents Day theme and want to. It's a challenge, kind of. There's a kind of two tempos going with each hand, and they just all want to, like, hey, I can play Parents Day. They send them to Lang. But yeah, you know, everybody was so hot. Everybody was killing it. Tuck, of course, doing his magic thing. If you think about that dream sequence where Arnold falls asleep and now he's a baby flying through the air, and his parents are kind of disappearing in the distance behind him. And then he's like crawling down the hall crying, and grandpa comes and gets him and then takes him up to his room, which we carefully, he takes him up the stairs. But I said, they haven't decorated it yet. Arnold's a baby still. So they're still grappling with the fact that apparently Miles and Stella died or something, and they're on their own and they're going to have to raise this kid. And it'll be part of the backstory that they help him decorate that room. Grandma, I picture, found that crazy rug and that wallpaper, and they kind of, grandma and grandpa somehow made the remote control couch. Well, that'd be cool. And they found all that hi-fi stuff, like at, you know, garage sales and stuff. And they basically, you know, made Arnold's perfect room for him as another just really dear thing they could do for him. You know, we'll make a little, you know, kind of tree fort you can hang out in. It'll be your like safe place. And so all that was stuff that I just saw that was an opportunity for me to put into that story. And I was painting myself out of, or trying to get out of a corner I'd painted myself into. And yet I also really need to say that when we made it and finished it, we were like, oh God, this is sadder than ever, which was not my goal. I was kind of trying to help you meet his parents and kind of maybe set up everything that followed. I didn't know yet. I hadn't gotten to the journal. That was something I literally thought of later. And then the Jungle Movie was Steve and I trying to do the first big Arnold movie. And they said, Nickelodeon even said, hey, obviously the parents are, the missing parents are the core mystery of the show. Let's find the parents. So the The original Jungle movie was they were going to go see him and find him. And Steve insisted that they needed to be dead. and I was like, oh, man, I'll try that on, Steve. And we did several early drafts where he goes to the jungle and the mystery is solved. They find the hidden city, but they find that the parents had died. And I am really glad, this is going to sound corny, but I'm really glad the show, they didn't order anymore and things were basically canceled. And they put out the first movie, the Arnold Saves the Neighborhood. And it disappointed them at the box office didn't make enough, kind of got killed at the movie theater. And that was the end, because that gave me about 14 years to read the hopes and dreams of fans. Many, many, many messages to me from people who were like, oh God, I hope you can finally make the Jungle movie. I'm so excited to see Arnold find his parents. And I was like, well, you know, a lot of things happened. Steve, and I were sort of after the show got canceled, Steve kind of got estranged from everybody and just kind of went off and was not part of any of our lives. And so our long collaboration was done. And then Steve died. And so there was no more Steve. And it was around almost just shortly after that where Nickelodeon reached out to me and they had a new administration and the people that were running Nickelodeon were like, hey man, why don't you get back in here and we'll take a look at this Hey Arnold thing and you know, reboot this somehow. And so I was like, well, if we're going to reboot Hey Arnold, we got to do the Jungle movie. And they were like, great, what's that? And I made this whole kind of pitch to them, a whole PowerPoint where I was like, this is Arnold 101. You know, it's about this, it's about Arnold and his parents are missing. These are the things that fans want to know the most. And by that time, and it took a lot of thinking about it, I'm really glad for all that time to kind of things to be kind of fallow and not happening. It gave me a chance to think about what is that wish that everybody has? The wish is that he gets back together with them. And a lot of people also feel like that's kind of imperfect because Arnold, he's got a hole in his heart and it makes him this kind of person. If everything gets kind of healed, won't that make, that'll take away that kind of central, you know, unhappy thing that kind of drives his existence. And how can Arnold still be Arnold if he gets his parents back? And I thought, look, you know, it's a cartoon. I can do what I want. I can have them be asleep for 10 years, even though fans have actually written to me and said, you know, their muscle entropy or whatever, just like people click literally wanting to get real with me about how the kids that were left with the hidden city have to like bathe them and kind of walk them around or something to kind of keep their, and I'm like, no, man, it's a cartoon. They slept for 10 years and then they woke up. And I said, it won't be perfect. He'll bring them back, you know, somehow this miraculously he'll find them and they'll wake him up. You know, didn't even know how that would happen yet. I was still trying to figure out what would happen, but he'll wake him up. He'll bring him home and then it'll be hilarious. They'll be home with him and kind of damaged goods, like not quite there. And I tried to even suggest that in the Jungle movie when mom says, hey, how about, you know, why don't we just make a day of it and go down and see that rainforest exhibit? And Arnold goes, mom, it's the first day of school. And mom and dad both go, oh yeah. Yeah, I knew that. And so it's like, they're funny. They're meant to be, they're never going to be quite the same. They had like a very weird 10 years, you know, sleeping in the hidden city at the top of a volcano. And so that, you know, all that stuff though, literally, I just kept going forward. I had some ideas, you know, I had, you know, especially Arnold, I'm trying to take care of that kid, man. I'm trying to, you know, have Arnold be okay. And so I decided in the absence of Steve and his, you know, strong feeling that they shouldn't, I said, nah, he's going to go wake him up and it'll be really cool. And in doing so, Helga will somehow, I didn't know yet. I mean, that idea about her using her locket to, you know, all that kind of came as we dug back in 2014, 2015, when we got the assignment. And I'm glad we did. I'm very happy with the way things turned out with the parents. But Parents' Day was just like a early some key exposition about who they were, and Arnold was going to end up with this knowledge, determined to find them. And so that's what happens at the end of Parents' Day. Arnold falls asleep. He's had this great day. He the night before, he had a series of dreams that made him realize that Grandma and Grandpa have been doing a really great job of parenting him, and kind of just realizing how great they are. And, you know, they're kind of too much for him, you know, like when they go to the Parents' Day competition and they're like, rah, rah, just boom, bye. Like they're doing all that kind of like go team Arnold. It's still embarrassing. It's like, oh my God, you know, my grandparents are so extra. And yet they, you know, Grandpa kind of amazingly, he's got that weird, like giant Q-tip, and he kind of knocks Bob off into the giant bowl of Jell-O. I was like, what a weird episode. But, you know, I wanted all that stuff to happen so that, and it was, I forget who mentioned it. It really was that I had an ending, you know, we're going to meet him, you know, I'll sort it all out. I'll play Miles and Antoinette can play Stella so we can kind of keep it really inside. And he really wanted everybody to just love these parents. They're so cool. They're like Indiana Jones, and they're kind of, he's sort of like, I don't know, they're like out there helping the humanitarians, you know, just like Arnold. And then in the end, when he gets in that plane that's on his roof, boarded by Tuck again, props to Tuck. When he gets out there and he gets in that plane and he, you know, pulls back on the stick and he flies off into the clouds, that was meant to be just like what you knew it. I mean, and which is really great. I mean, this is a classic example of like when I made this stuff, you three were kids then and you saw it and you got it, right? Oh, Arnold's, he's gonna look for his parents in his dreams. And then in the journal, we got to take it to the next step. He finds the map. So it's like, you know, the desire was there and the kind of hole in his heart and the kind of dream that he had of finding them and finding out the answers to these terrible questions. And then he finds the map. So now he has something physical. It's going to like, if I take this map to San Lorenzo, I can maybe, you know, pick up the trail where they disappeared. And, you know, still there's some stuff that was never answered, but, you know, to the best of my ability, I just wanted to take people there. I would point out that when I was a kid, I saw, of all things, a Shirley Temple movie. And I wanted to, even, I knew we'd be talking about this. I almost wanted, I'm sorry, I never got around to Googling the Shirley Temple movie. I don't know what it was called. You know how when you were a kid and you kind of flip through the dial and just pick up some old black and white film and go, huh, what's this? And watch it. I've just watched the last scene of that movie. That's all I've ever seen. I don't know what the movie's called, but she's flying with her dad and her dad's some kind of pilot and they're flying up into the clouds. And she's like, where are you taking me, daddy? And he says, we're going to find your mom. And the plane flies off into the clouds and you're like, what? Is he going to crash into a mountain? Or, you know, is he literally like, your mom died, and so we're all going to die too as we go, we're going to go join your mom? I didn't know. It had this weird, definitely, it made quite an impression on me as a kid. I was like, man, I love this. I you know, and as an adult, I was like, hey, I can cop that and have Arnold do that. But in a dream where, you know, nobody dies, but it was basically, I was just like always, I'm just like, there'll be something that I saw that a feeling that I want to recreate and use the Arnold characters and stage it with the Arnold characters in their world. And often, you know, it's really more about a feeling, and it's something like that where I'm like, well, I'll end it that way. Arnold will learn everything that Grandpa knows and Grandma. They'll tell him everything that they know about Miles and Stella, and he'll be that he now armed with this new information about his apparently really cool and wonderful parents. Arnold will, you know, literally in his dreams go looking for them. And it's super powerful. I can't watch it without crying. I can't watch Thanksgiving or Parents' Day without crying. And it reminds me too, when I mixed it, when I was in post, you know, Lang had done the score, you know, we were mixing it. We were finishing it. I mixed all morning, and then I took a lunch break and I went out, and somebody came to pick me up, and I was just standing out on the curb waiting for my ride to lunch. And I was standing out there crying and like wiping my eyes and going like, what the fuck? Why am I doing this? Why did I do this? Why am I making this thing that's about this super sad material? And I didn't know. I actually was kind of beating myself up. Like, what is wrong with you, man? You know, you, why are you doing this to children? And later it's like, hey, when, you know, because it's kind of our superpower to do sad, emotional stuff. And we will do our best, you know, kind of try to make it like something that we, you know, Lang's music makes it so kind of cool. It's like, you know, it's going to have, you know, Tuck's art and all the wonderful background paintings by everybody and the performances by everybody and Lang's music. I'm like, hey, well, at least it's going to be cool, you know, but it will be very sad. Then when I took it home, you know, always I'd go to the facility in Hollywood where we put it through, you know, make the final, you know, tapes, the master tapes, and we'd master it, put the credits on. And then I'd take a cassette home, a VHS tape, and show it to my family. And Matthias, my son, was about like 9 then. So he was Arnold age. And I watched it with them. I watched down Parents Day with my family. And I looked over, and Matthias is a very chill guy. It takes a lot to make Matt have big emotions. And I looked over and he was crying, and he said, why did you do this?
Very similar questions that we asked on our episode, right? It was like, man, yeah, this is killing us.
Yeah. And I, you know, for that, what can I say? I apologize. I realize that going on this journey with these characters, sometimes it might not be the mood, man. You're not a first date. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like a meal. And I felt like Thanksgiving was like a meal too. But Parents Day is super personal for me. It's about some kind of yearning that I have for things that elusive, things that I don't know where they went and I don't know how to get them. And I feel like that's a legit child feeling, right? We felt that way as children, and especially as children in a way, because there's more magic when you're young and kind of so much that is unknown and so much is a mystery. And man, people were not explaining shit to me when I was a kid. I was left to kind of come to my own conclusions. I had the kind of parents, they're very loving, wonderful parents, but they kind of let me come to my own conclusions. And they didn't tell me, you know, when it was time to go to college, they're like, well, good luck. You know, I hope you find something you love. And they didn't tell me, I want you to be this or that. And so I felt like as a child, I just didn't know so much. There's so much that I didn't know. When I think about those Italy, I was like such a child when I went to Italy. And the experiences I was having were not the experiences of a wised up, smart adult. They were like crashing around, like having all these like weird things happen to me because I'm more of a kind of a, I'm optimistic about stuff and I hope for the best, but I don't have anything to back it up. So heading out to make Parents Day, well, thank God I was as old as I was, you know, I was almost 40 by the time we got to there, you know, that I got to start Hey Arnold. I was 37 when they told me it was greenlit. So that shows that I'd been around, man. I'd been animating for more than 10 years. I'd been writing stuff for a while. I'd had a bunch of experiences by then. And so thank God I had the tools. And, you know, we put together that really great team that we talked about the last time. And, you know, the knowing that I could go to Tuck and Jim and my actors and my writers and go, help me do this. You know, I want to do something pretty kooky, and almost no oversight from Nickelodeon. When they got it, they were like, wow, let's maybe hang on to this and not release it. It didn't show up till like season five, right? I mean, in terms of when it finally aired. And I think you guys mentioned that in England, they got it right on schedule. So the international audiences got stuff the way we made it, and the American audiences, not necessarily. And I think they were. I think the reason they sat on it was they thought it'd be cool to kind of get out there when they were promoting Hey Arnold to kind of drum up an interest in the movie, which came two full years after, more than 2 years after we made Parents Day. And I was a little frustrated. I wanted to get a reaction and find out what people thought of Parents Day as soon as it was done. And yet I also was a little scared because, like I say, I came out of the mix, rubbing my eyes going, I'm so fucking sick of crying. I've been crying all morning. it's weird, man. I look at these cartoons now, some of these I've seen for a long time. And when I run them, I'm like, man, that's heavy. Especially Parents Day. You're absolutely right that it's a punch to the gut. And, hopefully it's a really satisfying punch to the gut.
Oh yeah, it's the best. I think it's probably the best episode. It's my favorite episode, I think, probably. I think it brings the whole series together. It's amazing.
Thank you. And we talk about how important it is it's really about taking care of that kid. You know, we really want to make stories that allow Arnold to be Arnold. And we want to you're doing weird stuff like that, girl trouble when Arnold acts out, Antoinette was so upset she was going to like jump out a window. It was like, she was really like, you can't do this to Arnold, man. We're all counting on that guy. You know, Arnold can't be a jerk. Arnold has to be Arnold. And Helga is so abusive and so mean to him, but we know what's going on. It's because she adores him, and so someday she'll be really good to him. And she hasn't yet, but you can see the sacrifices that she's made for him because she worships the guy.
Don't we all, though?
Sorry, Cody. I just was going to say that it is. It's like, the thing that's amazing is that these characters live, and we talk about them as if they existed because of the things that happen. And it's kind of a miracle to me to think that everybody could come in and that crew could come in and write and draw and support that. Talking about these characters like Eugene goes bad. Why is it so incredibly satisfying that Eugene goes bad? Because we've had 2 years of watching the guy. And we have a really good take on who he is. And he somehow has come to life and is real. And so that's the case with most of those characters. They in the stories, they turn into these like living things. And some stuff would be bad to do because it's not right. But when it's right, when Eugene went bad, it was super funny and fun.
I love that. As a note to end on, kind of recapping the emotional gut punches that we're still reeling from as a result of Parents Day, while also kind of framing, what's to come, what we have to look forward to. There's a trip to the jungle in our eventual future. And speaking for all of us here, I think we're still reeling from the fact that, we're thankful to get this combined masterclass on what it's like to work on your passion project while also getting a history lesson of one of our favorite works of art. And the fact that we got to get that twice is kind of absurd. So I guess thank you, Craig, so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I love getting to the bottom of some of the mysteries because there's so much that the three of you know and understand. I mean, your understanding, especially in your heart, understanding these things, the big picture stuff you guys get really well. And then I just feel like I can come along and do some kind of color commentary and fill it in like Lighter, for example. I love like Lighter. By the way, that the drawing of like Lighter, that's a portrait of Larry. And then Larry, I would have been like, what? What are they doing? They can't make me into this weird villain. But then he got voiced by Tim Curry. So that's probably like Larry Likeletter is probably his pride and joy is that his cartoon character was voiced by Tim Curry. He sings Nice Guys Finish Last, you know, as you will get to in season 5.
Fantastic, have a blast.
Yeah. So, you know, the stories behind this are often really fun. And the stuff that I wanted, but somebody else wanted different or like somebody would walk in and go like, I can't go on if you don't change this. This is really bugging me. That kind of stuff just indicates how much people cared. Steve Vixton really cared. Antoinette really cared. Tuck quit on me like 4 times. And I'd go, Tuck, you can't quit. You got to come back. And he'd be like, all right. Cause he really cared. You know, he was so upset or so mad about something someone did that he'd be like, I'm out. I quit. And I'd have to like follow him to the parking lot and go, come on, man, it's me. You got to come back. You know, I can't do this without you.
Oh man. That's just imagine if you didn't chase him all those times.
Yeah, I know. Luckily I was around. Good thing I wasn't off at the recording studio or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you are always around. We all follow you on social media. We love seeing your updates and kind of, you know, we don't have to always ask you in this format to kind of like pick your brain about Hey Arnold, but I guess if you would like others to follow you, where can people find you out in the world or preferably on the internet? I guess
so
for your sake.
I still am my only format or forum is Instagram, and it's just Craig Bartlett. So that's easy to find. And I'm always kind of surprised when people at this late date go, hey, I just found your feed, and the Arnold is their favorite thing. I'm like, what? I've been here squawking about Arnold for a decade now. and thank goodness for the social media, because it really did focus fan interest. And I always felt that my ongoing posts and presence at least helped that. And yet, you know, who knows? It's the decisions for more stuff come from people in places that, you know, I don't have anything to do with. But, you know, for people who love Hey Arnold, that's a real thing. They can read my current takes on where they are. And they both got through the pandemic. So Helga and Arnold, man. Helga and Arnold forever. They're soulmates.
Arnold and Helga forever, Craig forever. Thank you again for being here. And I guess for those listening, thank you very much for tuning in to Stoop Kids. This is a Hey Arnold podcast, if you haven't picked up on that by now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Stoop Kids Pod, and that's kids with a Z. This episode was produced by super producer Jason Daphnis, who you can find on Twitter at Nintendoofus. I've been Cody Narveson. You can find me on Twitter at Cody_BH.
I've been Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at Shiitake Harry.
I've been Emily Suey. You can find me on Instagram at Emily Suey. And thank you so much, Craig. We can't believe that we get to talk to you like this. This is phenomenal.
Oh, you know, it's my pleasure. Cody, Harry, Emily, you guys are great. I'm glad you love it. And remember, you know, we might get some details wrong. Only Encyclopedia Arnaldia over here can kind of totally set it straight. But you guys are completely like spot on with the emotional, you know, intellectual, emotional take on what's happening, what I was trying to do. And that's the deepest satisfaction that I could ever, ever have, is to have my, you know, creative thing be so well understood and so deeply felt. It's always amazing. I didn't know it then, and I understand it now because of stuff like this.
I am going to be writing that comment for a long, long time. Thank you again, everybody, for tuning in, and stay bold.
All right.
Wow. Yeah, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much this means to all of us. It's really amazing.